diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, the College of New Caledonia has just welcomed its first female president in 54 years.
It really signals that there have been some changes in terms of the gender inequities and that women are moving into these roles on a more regular occurrence. And I look forward to leading the college with my perspective.
The 16 days of activism against gender-based violence comes to an end on December 10th. We'll travel to Smithers, BC and to Knowlton, Quebec, where women's coalitions and organizations are working to break the cycle of physical, verbal, and psychological violence.
Prevention is tricky in that trauma is intergenerational. So it's finding a place where we can be the support that the person wants and needs and recognize that they are the best person to understand their story and know what they want and need. Prevention starts young.
And back to Revelstoke, British Columbia, where the residents of two of the biggest mobile home parks may have a chance to buy their land.
Even if individuals can't purchase the land that their homes are sitting upon, we would still want to see people not displaced and them paying rental rates, lease rates, similar to pad rental.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. The College of New Caledonia in Prince George, BC marks a new chapter as it officially welcomed last November Mrs. Cindy Heitman as its first female president and CEO. The CNC College is now on its 54th year of operation, and the symbolism of this moment isn't lost on Heitman. Heitman's credentials originate from CNC itself, where she spent her first 2 years of higher education. Journalist Ian Craig caught up with Mrs. Heitman just a few weeks on the job. She cites the challenges the institution faces.
It's a pretty big deal as far as the symbolism and significance of the institution in stating its first female president. What do you think that really means?
It means that tremendous progress has been made in terms of gender equities. To realize that this organization's been open for over 50 years, and I am the first female to be hired in the leadership role, is something that is just a deep honor. I think what makes it even more significant for me personally is that I'm from this community and I'm from the North. So not only am I the first female, I'm also from the community. And it really signals that there have been some changes in terms of the gender inequities and that women are moving into these roles on a more regular occurrence. And I look forward to leading the college with my perspective.
And this is an ongoing challenge. On one hand, this is a significant marker. It's a big milestone. And on the other hand, it's about time. 50 years into the existence of the institution, you think it would have happened by now. But we are here now, and that carries weight. And you are of the North as well. Not only are you from Northern BC, you're also an alumni of CNC itself, no?
That is correct. I attended this college my first 2 years following graduation from secondary school.
Fantastic. Oh, and were you going to high school here in Prince George and then advanced into CNC? Or how did that trajectory work for you? What was your educational path?
My educational path is right here in Prince George. I attended school K-12. Here, I graduated from what's now known Chastity Kelly Road and transitioned right away into CNC.
CNC now versus CNC then, as we just mentioned, it has evolved a lot over time. What are some current challenges the institution is facing? What do you want to tackle?
Do you know, I think for me, it's really looking at how CNC is unique to other post-secondary colleges, given the fact that we are in the North. We're an urban setting with regional campuses in some of the smaller communities. And education in the north looks very different than education in the lower mainland or the Okanagan. We face different types of challenges in terms of our unique geography, but also are our programs relevant to what's happening here in the north? And that's something that we're thinking a lot about. We also are looking quite deeply into Indigenous education and the calls to action and the action plan for DRIPA in British Columbia. And specifically, how do we decolonize and indigenize post-secondary so that our programs are accessible for all, and really looking at how do we support Indigenous learners. We do know that international education is something that is being spoken about a lot, both at the provincial and federal level. It's important that we continue to represent Canada in the way that we're welcome and inclusive, but it does bring some different challenges in the sense of equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, and ensuring that we have the right supports and programs for students who are attending here from another country. Kind of exciting if you think about that. These students have an opportunity to come and learn here in Canada, and how do we make that the best experience we can for them?
I imagine there's quite a few obstacles in the way of having equal opportunity for everybody and advancing equity so everybody actually has that equal access to education. What do you feel are the perhaps the most significant obstacles in actually delivering these goals you just mentioned?
And that's something I'm still really exploring. I've only been here for in the president title now. I'm starting my third week. But I can look at it from a systems point of view and from other experiences. I think sometimes we have some ways of doing things in our system that can ultimately be barriers. How do we communicate what we're trying to share? How do we offer instruction so that it's equitable for those who are able to be on a campus, but for those who aren't? Then you have the, if you're choosing to go to an electronic type of learning experience, how do we ensure that we've got great connectivity so that students can access that information? And how do we respect and respond to the cultural expectations of learners from different cultures and communities? And I think those are some places that we can start just asking some questions. How do we create that space so that everybody feels like they belong and can contribute to the CNC community? So these are just some of the big questions we're asking right now. More to come as I spend a bit more time here.
It sounds ambitious. The College of New Caledonia has had a relatively steady change of leadership over the past 4 years following Henry Reiser. And since then, I believe there's been two presidents. How long do you feel it takes to instate the changes you want to make? And do you think you'll be around long enough to see those changes through?
For me, I mean, I've lived in this community my whole life. I have no intention of leaving, you know, barring anything disastrous happening in my life. But to make the kinds of changes, when you're looking at organizational change, it takes years for that to happen. Your first few years are really about mobilizing, relationship building, creating communities to do this work. I truly believe I don't change things unless I know they can be sustainable. So whatever happens as the college goes forward, will those continue after I leave? And it takes time for that to happen. My plan is to see things through until I know that it is in a place of sustainability and that it will continue to grow, thrive, and flourish after my departure. I don't know how long that will take, but it will take some time.
What are your long-term aspirations, plans for the college?
Do you know, I'm a huge believer in the college, and I'm a huge believer in staying in the North. My long-term aspirations, if I could, you know, have something to measure my success, it would be that we have a vibrant, thriving learning community that meets the needs of people living in the North, where everybody walks into our buildings, whether they're the main campus here or regional campus, and can see themselves reflected in that environment from a cultural perspective. Are we really making gains in Indigenous education and seeing representation in the field and even within our own walls of students who identify as Indigenous. Do we create spaces for inclusion? And that includes, you know, students with diverse learning abilities as well. And how do our programs really meet the needs in the North? Are we, you know, staying current with economic development, with trends? That's how I will see us as successful.
Thank you. I hope you have a great rest of your day and a really good week as the semester begins to wrap up.
Yes, it does. I'm looking forward to the start of a new semester. There's always some excitement that comes with that.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
All across the country, women's coalitions, organizations, individuals are taking a stand against violence towards women. November 25th to December 10 is designated as the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. In Quebec, the 12 days of action against violence towards women is a campaign that was created following the École Polytechnique massacre in Montreal on December 6, 1989, where 14 women lost their lives at the hand of a gun men who targeted them just because they were women. It is part of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. We'll have two stories today on that subject. First off, to Quebec, where the coalition of women's groups Haute-Yamaska and Brome-Missisquoi are calling on the population to take a stand in support of victims of gender-based violence. This year's theme is collective responsibility, which means daring to denounce violence against women. The goal of the campaign is to sensitize and educate the general public around the forms of violence that women face in society and to encourage concrete action at the government level to prevent situations of gender-based violence. Journalist Taylor McClure spoke with Brielle Laramé from the Avanti Women's Center and Audrey Fontaine from the Women's Center for Help and Fight Against Sexual Assault, Centre d'aide et de lutte contre les agressions à caractère sexuel. That's in Quebec's Brome Missisquoi region.
There's often people don't even know like what classifies a type of violence, and often with your prevention you have the reaction of like, oh, I didn't even know that I was living a type of violence, but I did live it.
That goes all the way to a school system, that the school system should put in place prevention and education around sexual assault and consent.
And that's actually been a big topic of conversation, right, at the provincial level with the different cases of sexual assault that have emerged from our schools within the last year. And why is this campaign so important at this time? Is violence against women a growing concern here in the Eastern Townships?
I think it's so important to highlight it every year because violence against women continues to be an ongoing reality, and there are many women seeking support every year. So according to data from the year 2022-2023 at Maison d'Alice Damaré and Horizon Boréen, which are both women's shelters, 90 women were sheltered this year, well, in those years, and 161 women received outpatient services related to domestic violence. Of the 90 women sheltered, many were experiencing other issues as a result of the violence that they had suffered. 12% had substance use problems, 39% were experiencing mental health-related difficulties, and 10% were homeless, which brings us to another problem in today's climate, which is because of the current context of inflation and the housing crisis, women may be even more reluctant to leave their spouses.
Have you seen an increase in requests from women who are seeking services that support women in situations of violence? What patterns have emerged at your own organizations over these last couple of years?
Well, we were able to see that in sexual exploitation, what's happening is because, like Brielle has mentioned, with the information is now women have less the capacity to be able to pay at the end of the rent. So it's increasing in the sexual exploitation. And also since the Me Too movement in 2017, there was an increase in demand since more people are speaking out and breaking their silence now. And also since the arrival of the internet, it added a new form of sexual violence, sexual cyberbullying. So anything that has a sexual character on the internet.
Honestly, I wouldn't say that we witnessed a change in women seeking services for domestic violence at Avante. I think it's stayed relatively steady. But the reason I think this is because often I have people, I have women disclose that they were in situations of domestic violence, but it's often after they've already received services at a shelter that they disclose it to me. I think the reason we don't see as much at the center is because they often tend to go more towards shelters and that who are more specialized in domestic violence cases. So we see them like as an aftermath of that, after they've already like sought the help out, they come to us for more of, I guess, the social aspects of the women's centers. Like the theme of this year is collective responsibility. So it's really to highlight that everyone has a role to play, and just staying silent and not bringing up violence against women only serves to make the violence worse. It's not just the responsibility of female victims to bear the burden. Everyone should take real action to make sure that we bring about real social change.
I also wanted to highlight that this year in 2023, there was 9 femicide and 4 children were murdered in the context of domestic violence. Therefore, 13 lives were taken away. And this is why it's still important to highlight the 12 days of action.
Thank you both again so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Well, thank you for having us.
Experiences that are shared all across the country. In British Columbia, these 16 days of activism against gender-based violence are hopefully slowly breaching the cycle of violence. The 16 Days of Activism is an annual international campaign that kicked off on November 25th, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. The campaign was started by the Women's Global Leadership Institute in 1991. The BC Northern Society for Domestic Peace, NSDP, is a non-profit organization that has been in operation in Smithers for 33 years. Their housing for women and children escaping violence is called the Transition House. It's a safe place to recover and rebuild. Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, spoke to Bronwyn Young as the coordinator at the NSDP Transition House in Smithers. She wanted to underline the fact that men have to be part of the solution.
So this week is the last week of 16 Days of Action, and the goal of these 16 days are to bring awareness to the issue of violence against women. So not that I need to tell you this, but just kind of for some context, that the UN suggests that one solution really lies in robust responses, including investment in prevention. Mm-hmm. However, data on how much nations are committing to counteract violence against women and girls still remains glaringly sparse. Does Passage House or NSDP participate in prevention measures? And if so, what are they?
We do. So I want to just first give a shout out to the men who are doing the work. I believe that that's where the solution lies, is with men being a much bigger part of the solution. To the men who call out when they see another man doing something inappropriate, saying something inappropriate, to the man who has those uncomfortable conversations with their friend, to the man who chooses not to use violence himself, thank you. We need more of that, and I hold you up. Thank you so much. So as far as, community prevention, we have at NSDP something called the camp program, where we go to typically planting camps. They're remote, they're co-ed, they're typically young, healthy people, and sexual violence, harassment, other forms of violence against women happen in those camps. So we have now, again, part of the men being the solution, one of the presenters is a man. It makes all the difference. So that has been really helpful and has expanded exponentially since we started, because people are seeing that it helps. And so we've moved into wildfire camps. We're in Alberta. There's more people who are better familiar with that here, but that's a great program. Also doing public speaking, talking to you, having conversations with people who have the ability to make change, collaborate. Prevention is tricky in that trauma is intergenerational. So it's finding a place where we can be the support that the person wants and needs, and recognize that they are the best person to understand their story and know what they want and need. Prevention starts young. And so an SDP has lots of amazing programs and counselors for, you know, children all the way up to seniors.
You know, I feel like so often I'm asking the person who's the busiest to give me their time. And I mean, that, you know, that's kind of just how life works. If you want something done, just ask a busy person.
Yeah.
But what supports do you feel that you would like to see also in the community? I'm not sure if that's something you feel comfortable answering, but, you know, it, you know, are the RCMP kind of, are they doing enough? Are their programs proactive? Maybe even in, you know, town council as well? Is there kind of supports that you would like to see in the town or ones that you want to shout out maybe as well?
I think that the RCMP are doing a better job in understanding trauma response, mm-hmm. in understanding disclosures and what that can look like and how it doesn't follow a perfect line typically. So I would be encouraged by that and really like to see more people in positions of authority, in positions of decision making, get that trauma-informed understanding about what happens to the brain, what happens to the body, and how it doesn't maybe look like what you think it's going to look like. I think that that would be helpful. I think that that's a gap that could, you know, I see that happening in the RCMP, and I'm grateful for that. So that's a gap that could still be brought together. I think that, you know, we all are witnessing these same problems that are pretty out in community where violence and trauma and dysregulation are rampant. What we deal with at transition houses are more what happens behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. They're often things that families feel shame about, that, you know, sometimes it feels like that the only thing that a family has a harder time with than the abuser is the truth teller. And so how do we get the narrative to shift on whose responsibility is it to not use violence? Mm-hmm. I think that's, and where are the skills to do that?
Yeah.
Because people come from different places. People have different skills. Not every man who uses violence wants to use violence. So, you know, having our men's program be funded sustainably is a gap. We are struggling right now, women, children, men, communities. The more we can be compassionate and be open to each other, the better things will be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many of our journalists across the country also worked on this subject this week. We learned from Edward Sweeney that the city of Peterborough became the 74th municipality in Ontario to declare gender-based violence an epidemic. And Owen Thompson in Toronto reports that 62 red roses were placed in vases for the 62 women and children in Ontario who were killed in the past 12 months.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
And as we close the show, we stay in British Columbia, where residents of the two biggest mobile home parks may have a chance to buy their land. The owners of the two biggest manufactured home parks in Revelstoke want to turn them into stratas. The Cummings family, who owns four parks in Revelstoke, recently sent out a letter to residents of Glacier Heights and Oscar Street parks saying they're starting the stratification process. They say they have no intention to displace their tenants, who currently own their trailers but rent the land they occupy. Rezoning from manufactured home park to strata would create individual titles for the lots the mobile homes currently sit on. The intent of the city's new policy is to mitigate the displacement of mobile home park tenants due to development. It is not yet known if the tenants could even afford to buy their lots. Details with Megan Dooling.
Encouraging owners to stratify to prevent the displacement of tenants is the main intent of a policy the city passed in the summer. The Manufactured Home Park Redevelopment, Residential Tenant Protection and Strata Conversion Policy. Paul Simon is the city's lead planner.
It's always a contentious issue, and it's also an emotional issue, very rightfully so.
There are 19 parks in Revelstoke, 494 mobile homes, making up around 13% of Revelstoke's housing stock. Johnson Heights is already stratified.
You can think of Johnson Heights Mobile Home Park as what this policy is striving for, should someone want to redevelop one of the existing manufactured home parks.
So how is the city encouraging owners to go through the stratification process instead of building up the land and selling hundreds of townhouses for $800,000 each? Which, Simon admits, is a financially appealing route. If a park owner wants to redevelop, they have to apply to the city for a zoning change. Under the new policy, the owner must first consider rezoning to a strata and give tenants the right of first refusal to buy their land. Before applying to rezone, owners have to create what's called a manufactured home park tenant notification. The owner has to give it to each tenant. This plan has to include a lot of information, including the owner's redevelopment plans and the timing, tenants' rights, a copy of the city's policy, and resources to help the tenants assess the conditions of their homes. The owners also have to create what's called a manufactured home park tenant relocation plan. It has to include a profile of the number of tenants in the park, each of their housing needs, and relocation preferences of each tenant. The owner of the park has to provide the relocation plan, as well as responses from each tenant when they apply to the city for rezoning. The owner also has to provide a profile of the condition of each mobile home in their park and its ability to be moved. In its policy, the city is encouraging owners to stratify.
The first option that we want to see is stratification. If stratification can't work, then we want to understand why. Yeah. If that rationale is legit, then the next option is to pursue what we call residential rental tenure zoning, so that everything has to be rental, which is a dire need in this community, yeah, which is why we have it set up as option number two. And then the third and least desirable option, which is more the status quo in some municipalities, mm-hmm, well, redevelop, provide appropriate notice, appropriate compensation, and then we want 25% of the units secured under a housing agreement so that the rent is reduced or the sale price is reduced, whatever the model is the developer is ultimately choosing.
So the third option is redevelopment into homes that will go on the market. The owner has to offer their current tenants the right of first refusal to buy these.
The city doesn't need to support the rezoning applications, and it is definitely something that staff will want to work with the developer on so that we can bring forward a viable plan to council.
The thing is, the city doesn't know how lot prices will be set or if financing will work. According to Simon, this is precedent-setting policy in BC.
We want to make sure the intent of the policy is followed where people aren't displaced. And so even if individuals can't purchase the land that their homes are sitting upon, we would still want to see people not displaced and them paying rental rates, lease rates, similar to pad rental.
Paul Simon estimates that the process to rezone from mobile home park to strata will take 8 to 20 months. The Cumming family hasn't yet applied to rezone the two mobile home parks. Charlene Cumming said in an email that they're just starting the process of stratification and that there's no guarantee the city will approve it. They don't have a time frame for when they will submit the application. She said their tenants will be notified. According to the policy, the company has to notify tenants 2 weeks before they submit the application. Cumming wrote, "We're very thankful for all our tenants, both past and present, for their choice over the years to live in our parks. We've done our best to be good landlords, but it's time for a change. We're going to try and figure out a way to hopefully be able to accommodate every one of our tenants."
And that's it for us at Viewpoint. Special thanks to our team, journalist Megan Dooling, Pamela Hassan, Taylor McClure, and Ian Gregg. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the precious help of your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao. Thank you.
Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.